Welcome to Indoctrination, a weekly conversation series about protecting yourself from systems of control. I'm your host, Rachel Bernstein.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for listening all over the world. It is very, very exciting to all of our listeners in the US and in Canada, in the UK, and other places where we have so many fans of the show, which is very gratifying. And over the last couple of weeks, to our great number of listeners in the Netherlands, New Zealand, Italy, Switzerland, Finland, and to our listeners also in Japan. Please be in touch and let us know, as always, what speaks to you about the show. And for today, we have part two of my conversation with the dynamic duo of sisters, Liz and Rachel. Our returning guests, Rachel Holt and Elizabeth Humble, are sisters who were raised in an independent fundamentalist Baptist church they've now identified as a cult, Cornerstone Baptist Church in Colorado Springs, Colorado. In 1998, Rachel was the whistleblower instrumental in the eventual arrest and criminal conviction of Charles Dean Miller, the son of a pastor who would become known to be a decades-long serial pedophile. After law enforcement investigations were corroborated by multiple generations and dozens of victims, his sexual abuse of underage girls was discovered. Liz and Rachel's forthcoming memoir, tentatively titled The King James Virgin and Other Myths of the IFB, tells this story. Rachel and Liz are returning to the show to continue telling the story they began last week and offer further insights into their harrowing experiences in the hopes that they may help listeners who may have been through similar traumas. So, if you have not already, please go back and listen to last week's episode where they introduce their story. Here are Rachel and Liz now. It is so nice to be able to continue my conversation with Rachel and with Liz, the dynamic duo of sisters. I mean, I just love your relationship with each other, just how you've been through something together, which is very bonding, but you've also been healing together and speaking out. And also really, I think, honoring each other's experiences and honoring the ways you want to approach this in different ways. And there's a really nice example here about how people do it in different ways, and it's okay. It's what works for you. It's what you, it's based on your personality, based on your experience. There isn't one right way to be tackling this. It's sort of the right way for you, but it still moves things forward, and hopefully with education, prevention, but also for your healing. So I really like that you can talk about how you've done this and how you've approached it in different ways, but just as effectively. And I think it would be great to pick up the conversation talking about kind of the breaking point and breaking free and what helped once you left. And also, you know, to talk, Liz, you were mentioning just before we started recording about how you didn't report the abuse because you didn't know it was abuse and you thought you had been the temptress, basically, right? That you had made at age 15 or younger, you know, some man approach you in a sexual way. That is an archetype that, you know, women basically have needed to fight against in order to be taken seriously, in order to be seen as having been victimized and abused. And the whole idea of like the siren and other ideas of, you know, women having this power to draw men in for somehow the man's destruction. It is a really dangerous idea, but it repeats itself in mythology and stories and history and still in modern life in a lot of environments, countries, and religious organizations. So there's a lot to cover here, and it's just so nice to have you back. So for the people who haven't yet heard the first part, please listen to the first part so you get a sense of the story more from the beginning. But also, just in case people have not yet been introduced to you, if you don't mind taking a moment and just saying who you are and what you do and why you're here talking about your experience. So Rachel, do you want to start?
Sure. I am Rachel Holt, and I am a mother. First and foremost, I teach dance and Pilates. I consider myself a movement specialist, and I currently reside in Southern California. My sister and I are writing wrote a book, and we're also doing a podcast as well along these same lines that Rachel Bernstein is doing a really good job of talking about in terms of the clinical aspects of healing from our journeys. So happy to be here.
Nice, nice. And movement. I like that, movement specialist. Also just moving this forward too, you know? Okay. And Liz, how about you?
Okay. I am Liz, and I am, I live in Oklahoma currently. I've lived many different places, but this is where I'll probably end up because my kids are now grown. I've got 3 daughters. I've got 2 granddaughters. And I think the last time I didn't have the third or the second granddaughter. So now I do.
Wow. Nice.
And I cut hair. I'm a barber. Also have a food truck and a alteration business. And I stay very busy with family and everything like that. So along with, like Rachel said, the podcast and the book, and we do a lot, but we love to stay busy and we do it well, I think.
Yes. Yes. And congratulations on a new grandchild. Lovely. Yeah. So let's pick this up. I think, you know, we were going to talk more about the breaking points and moving forward from those points. Is there more that you wanted to mention, though, from your experiences within the group that help us understand those breaking points? Because I know it got touched upon, but I don't know if there were more details you wanted to share with our listeners just about what got you to that point of saying, I can't be here anymore. Liz, do you want to start?
Shortly after my abuse when I was 16, I started questioning everything. I felt like at the time I had a great relationship with God, and the things that I was seeing that was going on in the church cult was not something that God would love. And so I started questioning things, and I would get told that, you know, you can't question this because this is the man of God. And so I graduated. I was 16 when I graduated high school, and I started going to they would call it a secular college, but it was a music school when I was 17. And about a year later, I met my husband, and he had come there he had just moved there out of college. And so his brother was involved in the cult. And so I met him, and I was very happy to see somebody from the outside that wasn't raised there that I was absolutely attracted to and wanted to. You're taught to get married and have kids. Like, that's your goal. So when I saw him, I thought, this is my way out. Nobody just leaves that environment without what you would call repercussions or something like that. There was many times that my husband and I have talked about now, because I did end up marrying him. We married in the church and then shortly thereafter left. But there was many times that we said, oh my gosh, if we would have just had a conversation, we would have left way before, because we didn't communicate. We followed everything they said. My husband was, like I said, a little bit more, not as much of a follower as I was, because I was raised there and it was ingrained in me, and he questioned a lot of things. but we didn't talk about it. Once we started talking about it, we were like, we have got to get out of this. We don't. And we knew we could not live in Colorado Springs. We knew that if we left this environment, we were going to have to move. So he began looking for a job. Once we had a conversation, there was a good friend of ours that was yelled at from the pulpit in this one service. And he actually called them out, said all these terrible things about them, which was common in the cult. If anybody stepped out of line or did something according to not what they thought you should do, he would call them out a lot of times by name and say, you know, call them a snake or, you know, horrible things. And that was our conversation. That was the night we had a conversation. And we were like, this is not something that God would want. There was no way to talk about people like that. And they were good people. And so we knew we were going to leave. I didn't tell any of my family this. I was just like, we just began the process. He started looking for a job. And meanwhile, while we were trying to figure out how to get out, my sister was the actual breaking point where we were like, okay, it doesn't matter if we can get out of here, we're done. And she can maybe pick up there and tell you her side of the story as to why we left.
Okay, so before that happens, a couple of things I want to mention. And I understand the idea of someone you love being the breaking point. That can really happen where you think, okay, I'm a little more hesitant to kind of act on my own behalf, kind of learn not to do that, and to also take my emotions seriously and think they have any validity, but I can't handle watching my loved one suffer. And so that is often a prompt for people, whether something's happening to their children, to their sibling, to their parents, and it helps them really see things clearly on behalf of somebody else. And at the same time, you said something really important. I mean, everything you said was important. This one thing, though, that I hear so often is, if my husband and I had just had a conversation, we would have left earlier, right? You spend a lot of time together, I'm sure, but you don't talk about this. And you also, I think, don't quite know that you can, and you don't know how to even say it, and that it's okay to be upset. And you might not know that the other person you're with is equally, sometimes even more so, upset about certain things until you have that conversation. And I think that's why conversations are kept to a minimum. And you're supposed to go to people within the church, not to each other, you know, if something's on your mind. And also the idea of someone getting up on the pulpit and from on high, berating and shaming someone in a service. Oh my goodness. So that also happens so often. That public shaming is one of the most successful forms of behavior modification. And people will do anything to not be that person who's then being yelled at. And it's unfortunately really powerful because it's such a horrible thing when it happens. And I think people don't know to think, not what is wrong with the person who's being berated, but what is wrong with the person who's doing that to them, who is using this forum, this spiritual forum, to just, you know, be mean. So it's an interesting moment where that was part of your breaking point. Like, this is wrong. This doesn't feel connected to how I see religion, how I see God. God doesn't feel like that, you know, God would not be cool with this, right, from your perspective. So that is so interesting. There's so many things in what you just said. Just, I know we just got started, but there's already so much to talk about. Okay, so now switching over to you, Rachel. So what was Liz referring to about what happened to you? I know you touched on it a bit, but I'd love for you to expand on it while we're talking today.
Sure. And I do believe we discussed at least the abuse, the initial, right, and all of that in the part one. And then also sort of the catalyst, which was with my niece, when I saw, you know, my abuser physically holding my niece, that was sort of, again, it's a like micro macro where, you know, I was ready to leave. I didn't share or have a conversation with my sister yet. I saw someone I love being harmed, potentially harmed by the same abuser. And that spurred me to then go talk to my sister and have that cause, right? So there's a circular pattern here that's evolving where when I sat down and finally, you know, sort of, I'll say, you know, verbally vomited on my sister with every, you know, what had happened to me, then that sort of pushed her to actually then really go, yes, we're out, we're leaving. And she told me, you know, everything that her and her husband had been discussing in the past in terms of also, you know, considering leaving the cult. And then from there, it sort of spiraled. My mom went and spoke with the leader at the time, and of course, deny. And then went to the Colorado Springs Police Department. From then, it was moved very quickly into a criminal investigation. And then throughout that criminal investigation, which again, and I don't remember all the details I gave on that, but I was not a willing participant for the most part. And I was just not ready. I wasn't, given everything that Liz just said about getting called out verbally from the pulpit, losing your entire, let's say, social network of people, and knowing that there is no going back from this sort of thing once you step over that line and it goes into legal proceedings, which we were always warned about, by the way. I remember when we were real young, Waco was a big thing. And everyone in that our particular brand of cult was in support of, you know, their religious rights to practice however they want to, and anti-government, where, you know, you never called, there was plenty of abuse growing up. You never called social services. We were trained that the government was the enemy, right? And that any higher authority was just God. And anyone else that came in between God and the leader was then the enemy. So even ingrained in me was that, well, regardless of whether I think it may feel right to go to the police and to tell them what happened to me, it didn't still feel that. It still felt as though I was going to be punished for it and that I had done something wrong and that involving this secular government officer entity was going to be a problem. And that, you know, somewhere down the line, I don't know, maybe it was a karma thing that, you know, you're just trained to think will happen. So that was a big deal. It was challenging. I think I shared details about the district attorney, which is pretty common. They're just overwhelmed with court cases. And he ended up taking a plea bargain and got out after 10 years. But there were multiple victims, not just myself. There were, I believe, 3 total that were willing and able to testify in the original court jury trial for the criminal investigation. But on docket or on, you know, testimony, they had, I would guess and I'm spitballing here, don't quote me on this, but I would guess anywhere between 12 to 20 other girls that were involved in it and that went on record testifying. Not that they were going to, you know, be in a courtroom setting, but were willing to at least offer their personal corroboration of the stories of their abuse. So it wasn't just me. And that's also one of the reasons why I did speak out. So I knew, one, my niece, I knew that there was potential harm there if my sister were to stay. 2, when I had come back and I went to Hiles Anderson College for 1 year, as I came back and began the process, like Liz alluded to, of, I say, quietly quitting, I also noticed that there was abuse. I could see it. If you've been abused and you know the abuser and you see his pattern of grooming and what he's doing, then it was very obvious to me when I got back that it was still ongoing and that there were multiple victims that he was still either grooming, currently abusing, or planning on. And it was just obvious. It was reading a book that you've read a million times before. You've seen it, you recognize it. It's, you know, right in your face. So I knew that was going on, and I knew, would my sister stay there, that would happen to her daughter as well. So there were multiple steps for me to get to the point to actually cooperate and, you know, go in and do the testimony, but it was an arduous journey, and it was awful, and I don't recommend it to anyone, and it's always long, they don't know anything new. They did not know what to do with this case at the time. I don't think on the scale of the criminal investigation, nor on sort of, I'm going to say separation of church and state was a big deal at the time. This was the abuse was in 92, 93. No prosecution or anything criminal investigation until 99. And then that carried on until 2000 when he took a plea deal. But at the time, I think the simple scale of it, I remember that there were so many officers involved. There were like the highest level detectives in the department at the time were both supervising the case concurrently. They were both working on it together. And I know that they had a ton of investigators below them, but really nobody had ever seen the scope of this many victims and in a religious organization that was controversial in a way that they didn't feel comfortable knowing how to handle it. So they had really, I don't think, had a lot of training or ability to say, where's the line between a religious organization and what their beliefs are? And then at what point do we say it's abuse? And then can we what do we have that we can prove it? And then we have to build this case. And because I think it was relatively new way of doing this, of course, they're trying to follow protocol, but the protocol doesn't quite fit the situation because of various reasons surrounding sort of that dichotomy between separation of church and state and how much do we protect or preserve religious rights, and then how much do we go, no, this is really pervasive and even, you know, over decades-long abuse of a serial pedophile. You could see that happening within the investigation, which as a survivor, it also gives you a little less confidence in the entire process itself. However, I will say that after it concluded, even though the lead detectives on that case were not happy with the verdict and wanted it to go to trial because they had done such exemplary work on this case and because they had such a strong case, they encouraged me to do a civil suit after. And we went on to do that. And that was, again, long, long process of, again, don't recommend getting that. But we eventually did win that settlement as well. So, you know, everything did work in our favor. But moving from that, I think part of, well, and also I think I did bring this up again, but I'll just remember that the victims advocacy group was also really good. And that is a high praise for them. Again, I don't think they knew what to do with this or me at the time. My abuse was at 12 years old. So at the time, I was almost 19. I was 19 when I went to the police. So there had been a very long time period, which is not uncommon in childhood sexual abuse, but it's not also common to see it in such a restrictive cult-like environment. So there wasn't a ton of trauma-informed, you know, let's say languaging within the investigation, within the victim's advocacy, even though they had dealt with a lot of, let's say, sexual abuse for minors or in terms of that, but not necessarily with the religious element that was heavily present in my case. So they did, again, follow protocol and did send me to a pediatric child-informed trauma therapist that I was required to do. And I do think that that saved my life. I know that, actually. I know that that saved my life. I did pretty heavily intensive therapy for the first, I want to say, year after the criminal, or once I went to the police and the authorities. And that included EMDR, cognitive behavioral therapy. We tried some psych drugs and was not really my cup of tea. And doesn't say that's not anyone's. It may work for you if you need them. But definitely cognitive behavioral therapy, which was quite intense at the beginning. And then EMDR therapy worked wonders for me in terms of recovering. And then, of course, it took me 20 years to write or start writing with my sister. So let's say it took 20 years, you know, at the minimum to really start feeling healed enough to go ahead and speak. And we did want it to be a manual. Liz and I looked around and said, well, what's out there? What is out there for not just survivors of abuse, but for child sexual abuse survivors within a cult environment like ours? That was our, right? So specifically for people that we knew and grew up with, that probably there are many more and they just haven't yet surfaced.
Right. It is a very important niche and an underserved population and misunderstood population where they have to deal with being asked the questions, why didn't you come forward? And why didn't you say no? And why didn't you? And I think more information out there will help prompt a listener, whether it is a friend, a family member, or a law enforcement, to not have that be the focus. Why didn't you? And because sometimes people avoid those conversations, so they don't want to be asked that question. And also, if the answer is because I thought that I had tempted this person, or I thought this is what God wanted, or in some other groups, this was my karma, or this was, you know, meant for me. There are a lot of reasons, and they're very valid in terms of the conditioning, and they just protect the perpetrator and, you know, make people get quiet who are trying to come forward. What I think is really important is to be able to do a how-to, a step-by-step, a manual, so that you're not just talking about the issue, but you're saying, here's some things that you can use that are really practical and that have a sequence, and it can feel really reassuring to know that that's out there. What I also really like about your story, Rachel, is that you got to say the word we. And so many people say the word I. I came forward. I tried to have the police or an attorney believe me. The fact that people lent their voices to, and you got to say we, is really empowering, can keep you really moving forward and feeling strong enough. I like also that your mom, and I remember talking about this during our last conversation, that your mom went for it and said, okay, I'm going to see what I can do here, which is great to have an advocate within your family, but especially a parent. It feels, I'm sure, really, really good. And also knowing that you're talking about 20 other people coming forward, and those are just the ones who came forward. So it can kind of give you a sense of the numbers, which is really a huge number.
It's astounding, but it's not uncommon. That's the scary part. But one thing when you were just speaking about that, having a we also, which is more powerful, right? Because when we think of numbers or in terms of building momentum and speed and sort of where it reaches a tipping point, we're starting to see some of that. And largely because people like you, you know, also doing the work for a long time, I also wanted to point out the languaging has changed. In 1999, 2000, it wasn't a trauma-informed therapist. It was abuse counselor, sexual assault survivor specialist. There were other terms for it. I just think the terminology has changed a lot, but I think it's largely due to a lot of we's starting to speak up about it and sort of bringing it to light. And there is more police-informed behavior on this now. And it's because of these things, right? They understand that it's maybe not their job to counsel someone in, you know, a scenario or, you know, to how to better support and protect and also take the testimony of someone who's had severe long-term sexual, emotional, physical abuse happen to them and be kind and careful about the way in which they're treated because of, right, these things. And if like I said, I think Liz and I are the OGs on this to some degree in this specific cult, right, that came forward and were able to like start some of that path. I think we as a contributors, you know, should all continue to talk. And that's that critical mass where it changes something.
Yeah, very much so. And I think knowing also that there are people like this attorney, Carol Murchison, who specializes in spiritual abuse cases, and a whole law firm around that. This is a very new thing. It could have been in place for decades already. It just wasn't. It just wasn't on people's radar. And I think they didn't know how to approach it. There's now an organization called the Consent Awareness Network, where they're really helping within the legal realm defining consent and what it means and what it doesn't, and that you don't necessarily go along with things just because you quote unquote let it happen and that you didn't say yes to it. The other part is that there are so many cases that I dealt with where I was right there, where someone's trying to be rescued or we're finding someone's child. The police show up and they just ask that person, are you over 18? And the person, if they are, says yes. Or are you close to 18? Yes. Well, then they're choosing to stay and there's nothing you can do. And that was so incredibly frustrating to see over and over again. But even if the person was younger, the police still didn't know what to do. They would then think the thing to do is to extract that person from their family. What? So traumatize them, put them in with some other family who doesn't really know how to help them. The perpetrators are still doing what they're doing. Nothing changes, but just you traumatize the child again. So what were the options? So the fact you're, yes, this is a new day and there's a lot more to still put in place. And again, in some areas and in some whole countries, none of this is available.
Well, and you know, legally, 18, right? But mentally, emotionally, developmentally, Liz has said that time and time again, where she was 16, 15 at the time of her abuse, and she was probably more like 12, right? And so there's a developmental age too that comes along with abuse. So if you're under those strict environmental factors that cause you to not have a real developmentally, right, from child development standards of what to understand or believe or even decide on your own, critical thinking skills, not common in cult environments, to be able to make a choice, an informed decision. It's not, that's never been evaluated. It's just a legal standard by which they're arbitrarily saying you're ready and able and willing to make decisions for yourself, which is not always the case.
Right. Not always the case. And I think going back to something you said, Liz, about how you didn't know how to be in the world outside. So here you would know that what is happening within the group is not good, but then that means you have to enter into a realm that's big and bad and scary and you don't know how to be in it. So a lot of people will, you know, it's the expression of better the devil you know than the devil you don't. Like they'll stay in something where they know how to be in it, even if it's abusive. I'm curious if you can talk more about how much that keeps people, I think, feeling stuck.
I think 100% it keeps you stuck because the fear of the unknown outweighs the freedom of getting out. You know, because honestly, I was there since I was 2. So I knew nothing else. Everything I was taught from the time I was 2 was this is the only way to live. I think whenever we were writing the book, this is when I got the most emotional of the entire book, was thinking back to that time when we left and how lost I was. I mean, I broke down when we were writing this part of the book, because I was like, the feelings that it brought up for me and how emotional it was to leave. I didn't feel like I had a home. I didn't feel like I had any friends. I had literally nobody. Rachel was going through all of her stuff with the court and all of that. And we were as supportive as we could, but I was like married with a baby. I didn't know. I mean, we went to church after church after church, and I would go and I would just sit there and bawl. And I'm like, this isn't it. This isn't it. We were just looking for somewhere to fit in. I felt like I didn't fit in anywhere. And I think that the fear of the fear of leaving that, and even, I mean, my mom would have never, I say that, but she would have never left if it wasn't for Rachel coming forward. I truly believe that. I think she still would have been there. if she didn't come forward, because my mom felt the same way. This was our home. This was our people. This was, you know, this was where we belonged. And I would have eventually left. I don't know if my mom would have followed if it wasn't for Rachel coming forward. So it definitely was a very scary thing. I mean, we had experienced other people leaving before us that would leave. There was some people in our church that owned a trash business and dumped buckets of, you know, an entire dump truck of trash in their yard. People from the congregation.
My God, I'm laughing, but it's awful. I mean,
I know.
It's so absurd.
And totally juvenile.
Yeah. They slashed people's tires.
Wow.
My car got keyed. Remember?
Oh, yeah.
This was right after our mother went to the leader and spoke with him and sort of confronted him on my abuse and his son, who had done the abuse, and clearly he knew about, meaning it was proven after that, that he actually did in fact know of his son's abusive behaviors and then chose to put me in a situation with his son as a teacher, right? And a leadership position in the church. So that's part of why we won our civil suit is because of some of this. It was already well documented that he had prior knowledge. Also a big, huge deal in terms of all the suits that are happening right now because they were able to show a pattern over multiple years. But as soon as my mom had gone to, and I was sort of out at the time, I had already kind of stopped going in general. And I worked at a local bar. And I don't know who told the people there, and someone found out. So somebody, and this was direct repercussion. So, and I was young, I was 19. I wasn't you were allowed to serve, you could not pour. So it was hostess versus bartender. I wasn't bartending, I was pouring, or I wasn't pouring, I was serving hostess. And I came out one night after work and somebody had keyed my car all the way around it once or twice. I can't even remember. And then they had written bitch on my hood, like with keyed, like a giant across the hood. So this, and I found out, yeah, I found out later, much later from sources that had then left that it was the youth pastor's wife that did that to my car. So it wasn't as though we weren't afraid for good reason. Right. We had very good reasons to both be afraid, like physically, you know, emotionally, mentally, even at work, that we could have had a lot of, you know, repercussions for coming out and saying anything because we had seen it over and over again. So it wasn't a fear that was unfounded at all.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. It was the youth pastor's wife. And she was probably going through her own stuff and not having the freedom to do her thing. But taking it out on you, I think because you somehow were going forward and or bringing shame or something, you know, there's sort of blaming the victim. But what was it like for you when you saw that? When you came out and you saw that on your car, did you feel scared? Did you feel upset? Did you feel impatient with what was happening? What was it like for you?
Oh, I was terrified. Up until that point, I sort of assumed that I was under the radar and nobody knew. And it was very close to the time when the police department is basically almost at the point of giving me a subpoena because they're saying, we have to have you come in and give your testimony because someone has indicated that there's been a crime happen. You were underage at the time the crime happened. Therefore, we're going to have to compel you, right? And you're an adult now. Therefore, we're going to have to compel you to come in and give testimony. Because if it's an ongoing thing and the abuser is in a situation where they can potentially abuse, then it was almost to the point where they were almost going to consider me an accessory after the fact or whatever, if I didn't speak about it. So it wasn't as harsh as I'm making it sound, but that's how it felt for me at the time. And up until this point, I thought, well, if I don't go on the record, if I don't go to the police, I can just bow out quietly. I won't have any repercussions. I won't get any trauma. They're not going to come after me. I just shut up, go away. That was my plan until I came out from work and saw this and knew that they knew where I worked. If they could find out where I worked, they could probably find out where I had moved to, because I had left my mom's house at the time. In some ways, Liz was a little bit more alone during this time period when she was having such a hard time. This was probably one of the biggest times, historically speaking, that we really weren't talking a lot or that close, because I physically tried to separate myself as much as I could from friends, from family even, and from the church. And it took me about a year before I kind of came around and was able to then rebuild a relationship with my family once they had left. So she was really on her own at the time. And I felt even more alone because I was trying to both physically and eventually did geographically distance myself. But when I came out and saw that, I was terrified. I mean, I knew, okay, that was them telling me, I know where you are. I know what you're doing. What I was doing working at a bar, you know, was not okay, right? That was the ultimate sin. And I was, you know, of course, going to a brimstone and hellfire, you know, right place. And, but I didn't know if it would stop there. And there was a part of knowing that they knew where I worked that also kind of pushed me into going to the police again, because if I hadn't gone, when would it have stopped? And I didn't know if there was any way that I would have any protection. And even after I went in to go to talk to the police, I was like, can you please like give me some protection? Like I was physically afraid to walk out of the police station. And they were, you know, they had to tell me, here are your rights. If anything happens, here's who you call. They gave me the, you know, number of the sergeant that I could call him immediately if anything happened. They said, if anything does happen again, you can do, you know, a criminal protective order. You can do a restraint, right? All of these things as a victim, survivor of that abuse that were available to me that I had no idea, right? So I was basically scared into going finally, partially because of that I knew that they knew. I mean, they're all criminal acts. All of these are criminal acts that we're talking about. You can't vandalize, right? You can't, right? You know, disturb private property. You can't. But of course, this was part and parcel for the course for these people. So it wasn't as though we didn't have valid fears in leaving.
Right. Yeah. And you know, going back to this, the term that I used before about something being juvenile, that's not to like to kind of underplay how frightening it is. But there is something about it, like just having the word bitch written on your car. It's like someone TPing your house. Like, really? Can we grow up and actually deal with this? And clearly you're feeling threatened by the fact that I am coming forward, and maybe we can have a conversation about this, you know, and try to figure out what to do and maybe how to change things so that people don't need to go forward with things. And so, yeah. So before, Liz, we come back to you talking about leaving and kind of entering the world and what that was like, and then talking, I think, more about healing process and moving forward. There was a story that you had talked about last time, which was the dumpster diving, that I want to come back to, because it is in those moments that you could really see your life and the conditions that you're living in, and if a community really cares about you or not. I mean, there's some moments that really drive the point home. And if we can come back to that story for a moment before we move forward, that would be great. Who would like to pick that up?
Well, my mom was always worked for the church. She was a teacher. Her salary was like, I want to say it was like $800 a month. You know, I mean, this is in the 90s.
Only during the school year, they'd lay them off for the summer.
Oh, yeah. For the summer, there was no pay. So she would do whatever she could by like, she cleaned hotel rooms. She would clean people's houses, just always odds and ends jobs. As soon as we were able to get a job, we were like, we need money. We're going to help out. But we had discovered Hostess. They would throw away all of their things that they didn't sell. And so in the night, we would go and dig through the trash can and pull out everything we could. And it felt like we had won the lottery. Shortly after, we did start a paper out, which I started that paper out. I was 15 and I had a permit. wasn't even supposed to drive without an adult, but we would go do the paper out, Rachel and I, and we would look behind stores. There was a, was it Dunkin' Donuts? I can't remember.
We would find the donut guy would drop them off at like, I want to say 4:30 in the morning, and we knew his car. So he would go into the 7-Elevens and take out the donuts that were from the day before and then put in new ones. And so we like got to know this guy, and he would just like give us the day old donuts instead of dumping them. And so we ended up like figuring out how to literally get food.
But the hostess, we would get bread. I mean, all kinds of things. Like bread was not something we even had. They were very, very anti-government, right? As Rachel has said. So you like getting any kind of assistance from the government was like, don't you dare, you know? So my mom didn't, I think she did food stamps a couple times for like a month. And then she said they got too nosy, so she quit. We never had food stamps. So like food was like something that we definitely cherished. And when we discovered the hostess store, that was huge. So we would dumpster dive almost every day. We would go back there and, you know, get in and, you know, hope nobody saw us. We were so like, but we literally were so excited to get like stuff out of the dumpster.
Well, and it goes back to that behavior modification thing, though, for I think in most cults, that is almost always present. It's one of the determining factors where we had to like sit there and grill our own definition of cult and make sure that we were following the lines of what would be considered. And that is financially, you know, basically dependent on the cult or financially invested in the cult in some way. So in our case, it happened to be we were so financially destitute, and my mom was so invested that we had this power struggle where they wouldn't allow her to get assistance because they didn't want them nosing into what she was doing with us, with our education, with our, you know, upbringing, you know, abuses that were happening also. And so then it put us in a place of needing to be in the cult to then, you know, get, okay, an education, my mom's work, which again was just the bare minimum to keep us alive. So the fact that we were not having, you know, nutritional values met, right, on just a basic needs level kept us there, but was also the reason why we were there too. And I think both of us realize that now but how even at, you know, 14, 15 years old, we did that all through high school too, by the way, but that how that taught us like to think outside the box in terms of, you know, what work you can do, what you can make nothing, you know, blood from a stone kind of thing.
Right. Yeah, no, I'm sure. I mean, the fact that both of you, you know, work, do a lot of things, are very enterprising, you know, I think that something certainly that's been fostered, like, you know, we need to do things to survive. And these are the stories that really paint, you know, paint a picture of your life and that you had to fend for yourself. And this is after your mom is, you know, teaching, working, and I guess only making a living for 9 or 10 months out of the year, which is very hard when you're raising kids. So to go to Liz, when you were just talking about suddenly entering into this planet that you were not raised on. Right. And how do you, where do you start? I can't imagine. What was it like for you? Even the first kind of things that you needed to do that you hadn't done before?
Yeah. So I think the first thing that we did, it's kind of funny, but we had never been to a movie. Very random, you know, like movies were terrible. You could not go see a movie because if you were seeing a movie, even if it was a clean movie, you were supporting the pornography industry. Like that is literally what they told us. And so I had never been to a theater. That was the first thing we did. And then I think we bought a television at some point. But as far as like the leaving and just, I felt so alone. So at the time I had a baby, my husband went to work all day. I would just be at home crying all day long. I was like, I don't know what to do. I couldn't call anybody. I didn't know anybody there. My mom still lived there, but she was working, you know? And so I felt like totally alone and abandoned and began to question like if we did the right thing, you know? It was constantly in my mind. Did I leave something and am I the one that's wrong? It was very, very much a mind fuck, big time. I constantly was terrified. I was terrified of going to the grocery store and running into somebody that was from there, going to the mall and running into somebody. And I mean, when we went to the movies, we were terrified of somebody seeing us. You know, I mean, it's just like the things that it was constant fear. And I told my husband, I said, I'm not going to survive here. We have to move. I mean, and he took a really terrible job in Texas so we could move. I mean, it was a terrible job. The pay was terrible. It was terrible, but he knew that it was so important for me to move. And he said, I mean, we've talked about it to this day. He never felt fear, but he was there for about a year. So he didn't have that instilled in him like I did, but he said he knew I was terrified. You know, and so he was on a mission to get me out no matter what. And so we did move to Texas, which was close to where his parents lived, and eventually ended up in the town where his parents lived with a better job and everything. But, and then I began to have friends, but even building friendships, it's so odd. It was so odd and it was hard. I was socially awkward. I didn't know how to carry on a conversation. I mean, people are talking about a show and I'm like, oh yeah, I never seen that. To this day, people will bring up stuff from, you know, the 80s, 90s, you know, and I'm their age. We're the same age. And they talk about some show and I'm like, sorry, I have a complete, like it's a blank slate for any kind of pop culture back then. Cause I have no idea. You know, some of the stuff I've went back and seen or watched or read about, you know, but definitely can't relate to a lot of things people talk about. And that's how I felt in conversations with people in the outside world that weren't involved in the cult when I was trying to make friends. And I mean, I just felt like everything that I said, I felt like I had to make stuff up to fit in, if that makes any sense. You know, like, and people would say stuff and you're like, oh yeah, I can totally relate. Could not relate at all, you know, but you're just trying to understand. And it eventually came. It was a lot of, you know, a lot of stuff. Also a lot of caring people that I came in contact with who were amazing. And I mean, there's people I know now that are friends that literally do not know how I was raised. They have no idea. You know, they just, because I don't talk about it every day anymore. You know, I think when we first left, it was all you could talk about. And, you know, it was a little bit confusing. And then you'd overwhelm people by being like, oh yeah, I was raised in this crazy church, you know, and people are like, okay. But they, they didn't understand, but that's literally all you know. And so the conversations came easier and easier as the time went on. But, you know, you make friends that with kids, you know, your parents of your children or other parents of kids that are your kids' age. I'm trying to say that correctly. And so, you know, you can relate on a parenting level, you know, and things like that. And I think I didn't even know who I was until I was well into my 30s because I just focused on being a mom and like doing all of that stuff. So I don't even think I could acknowledge, you know, any of my abuse, any of the stuff that happened. I just went into like mom mode and not talk about it. It became something that I did not want to talk about.
Interesting. Right. And, you know, I was happy actually to hear that one of the first things you did was go to a movie for a lot of reasons, but also because of pop culture. I want to be able to experience something. It also is showing that things aren't inherently evil. That it doesn't make you a bad person. It doesn't mean you're supporting the porn industry if you go in to see something else. And yeah, I mean, not everything is going to be just bad. I mean, some movies are bad. Okay. And it doesn't make you a bad person, different kind of bad. But, you know, that then you could relate. If someone said they went to a movie, you know what that's like, that you wait online and you get your ticket and you go in and you find your seat and then it gets dark and then the screen, like all the things that you haven't experienced, and the popcorn and the smell of the popcorn and whatever else. Those are all things that help connect you to the world, to society. And yeah, they might not be important things to talk about, but it helps you feel a part of the world. And you get to then enjoy things and also realize it doesn't change you as a human being. Your character is still the same, which can be very relieving. And yeah, being able to just go, oh, you have no idea what people are talking about. And you're just like, please don't ask me a follow-up question. Okay, no. Yes, I've heard of that band. Sure. Don't ask me what my favorite song is, please. Right. But I think it is, it's amazing just to see how much you were sequestered and then need to make friends. And it's hard because when you're an adult, you don't have someone to go to ask those questions like, how do I have a conversation? And it's hard, right? I mean, those are the questions I get asked as a, you know, post-cult therapist. Like, who am I? What do I like? How do I know what I like? How do I have a conversation about something that's not religious? That's not about furthering the mission, right? How do I talk about kind of nothing with someone for an extended period of time comfortably, right? All of it. Use money. Do what? All the things. It's very interesting. Just all the details that make you feel separate and then help you feel more connected. And it's very awkward. But I'm glad you brought that up. I'm wondering, you know, Rachel, if that also happened with you. And then we'll talk more a little bit about the healing process. Yeah, go ahead.
And this kind of, I think, is I've actually done a huge portion of this where I actually did a speech with a writing group of mine, and I did it live. It's a group in San Diego, but I workshopped it with a guy, and it's just hilarious. It's similar to Liz, and it also reflects both the stages in which we were at the time. So Liz had a child, and she was married, and right, and so the movie makes a lot more sense than mine does. And mine is about purchasing my first bikini. So I didn't give you all the details about where I worked at the bar at the time, but it was a bikini bar. Now, so Liz pushed the buttons gently, and she sort of had like a soft landing because she had maybe a husband and a child. And that made it kind of, oh, okay, you know, let's tiptoe and be kind of, you know,
mainstreamy and
sure.
Safe. Yeah.
And I just jumped off a cliff. Uh-huh. I mean, I went from 0 to 180 in, you know, 2 seconds because I thought, well, I don't have anyone. You know, it's just me. So, you know, you took away our food, you took away our money, you took away our everything that you told us was incorrect. Therefore, right? And I'm like a pattern recognition. Okay, if everything you told me was possibly wrong, then I'm going to test every single outlet that you told me was wrong. I'm going to do that to the nth degree and figure out where I find myself in the middle. So I went out, and I was already working in a secular job at the time. I remember my quietly quitting, and that was at a mortgage company for a home builder in Colorado Springs. And then I had recently moved out because of cult and mom. And so I was on my own, completely financially independent, and I needed a second job. So I heard some people had told me that you make decent money working in a bar because there's tips and drunk people give you money. And I thought, well, this sounds like my jam. And I went and applied to this job, and it smelled awful. I'd never been in a bar before, never tasted alcohol. I didn't even know what I was doing, but I just walked in, and there was like a bouncer dude. And he took me to this guy who was in the back in this dark, dingy space. And he's looking me up and down, and he's like, okay, you start tonight, you know, show up at 10 o'clock. The dress code is a bikini. And I was like, great. Not only do I not have a bikini, I've also never been like in public without like, you know, sleeved shirts. I also had barely started wearing pants at the time. Shorts had not even crossed my mind. Tank top, no. I mean, a bikini was kind of the farthest jump off the cliff of the longest jump you could possibly do at the time for me. So, And just like Liz, I thought, oh, you know what? I don't even know. I don't even know where to start. I don't know. I've never bought a bikini. I've never worn a bikini. I don't even know what to look for. I don't know what the sizing is. I have no idea. Also, I was terrified to go to the store and I didn't know what store to go to. So I thought, well, Walmart's right there. I'm going to go to Walmart. Also freaking out the entire time. I think I parked like a parking lot away because I didn't want anyone to see me going in. I was so afraid and it was so irrational, but I'm going in there and I didn't know what to look for. I had no idea what to like pick out. So I picked out like, I don't know. I think I just grabbed a bunch like, and I was definitely not going to try them on in the store because that meant I would have more interaction, potentially seeing someone I knew from the cult that would, you know, it would just ruin the whole thing for me. So I just like grabbed a bunch, ran through checkout, go home, you know, and finally tried a few on, but it was just harrowing in terms of like, oh dear God. And then at some point I was like, you know what? We're doing it. And, you know, grab your big boy balls, put them on and put on this bikini and walk through the door as if you own the place and just go for it. Right. And I loved that job. I mean, as naive as I was, as stupid as I was, it was a welcoming community. They didn't judge me. They may have, I might not have known, but I found a lot of friends there. It was, you know, people my age, they were normal, whatever that meant at the time to me. And I created a community. I'm still friends with some of them to this day, but they never judged, right? That most of them do not know that that's what happened to me the first night I walked through that job. So they have no idea. So, you know, it'd be hilarious to get some of them on, you know, and talk to them about it because some of them are still, again, we're still, you know, friends. But it was such a deep dive. And I was like, well, if not now, then when? And how do I know what's right unless I try all the buttons? So I just pushed the button and it was scary, but it also kind of set the stage for, you know, finding balance. It was like, well, that's kind of an extreme environment. If you go from like really strict religious cult oppressive environment into I'm serving beer at a bikini bar overnight, literally overnight. It was kind of like, nope, flip the switch. Okay, this is what I'm doing now. But it took a little while, but there is a balance. You know, we had to come to find the balance. And then, you know, where was the in-betweens of all that? But Liz sort of kind of, you know, she had a nice gradual, even though it is a steep, it feels like a really steep learning curve, you know, and I sort of dived into the deep end and then swam back.
Right. Right. I mean, that's a perfect metaphor also for wearing a bikini, that you dove into the deep end.
That's yes.
Awesome. Right. It's true. And I think, you know, just as we're finishing up, and there was just one last question I wanted to be able to ask both of you. When you go into an environment like that, you also, yeah, you're dealing with potential shame and feeling exposed, but also learning that your body and exposure of your body is not inherently evil.
Yes. Nobody had seen me. I hadn't seen myself out in public. But in terms of body positivity, like that was the best personal thing I could have done for myself because we were hypersexualized while being fully clothed. I was abused by this organization sexually, physically, emotionally, every way. So what better thing could I have done to then become right positive with the fact that I'm putting myself out there, you know, in this, you know, scampiest, whatever, minimal clothing to show my body as maybe it's objectified in a wrong way, but also how was it treated in that situation? So the corporality of having a body in a situation where you're not being abused, but you're also not following the rules in which the situation you were prior abused in while wearing a lot of clothing.
It's so interesting. Right. And then when you're in a bikini, also you still can't have people touch you without your consent. I mean, you have way more rights in that environment. That's so
absolutely
interesting.
And I will throw in this little nugget. The entire U.S. Olympic judo team or the bouncers at the bar is Colorado Springs. So the Olympic Training Center was right down the street and all the judo team were the bouncers. So the second anything happened, I had the squat team like right at my toe. And again, those were some of my good friends, like still to this day, they are. But it was like, look at the difference in the way that my female body was treated in different environments that are completely polar opposites with very different, you know, ideologies.
So powerful. So if just again, as we're finishing up, because I know we have to call it and we could talk for so much longer and it's so hard to end this conversation. So even though you may feel like you've already touched on so many incredible things and maybe you've covered them all, but is there something else that you think would be good for people to know who are going through that, who are leaving, who are trying to find kind of what is good about themselves, what's okay, what's safe, and how to be in the world? Is there something else that you realized or that you went through that has been something that has stayed with you, that's helped you feel good about you and safer in the world than you were there? And so I'm wondering, Liz, if there's like this pearl, that something that you hang on to that helps you.
I don't think there's a specific thing, to be honest. I do know that it's hard. It's extremely hard, but it's so worth it. I know from like, my kids are the age, some of them are the ages that now that I was when I left the cult. And I raised them very differently than I was raised in the cult. And I never pushed any kind of religion or anything like that on them. I let them decide all that stuff for themselves. If they wanted to go to church, great. If you don't, great. If you want to believe this, I don't care. You need to figure it out for yourself. I mean, as I left, I think that was one thing that I never got to figure out what I believed. Until I was completely out, I had to reassess, do I even believe in God? Do I even believe in church, organized religion? Do I, you know, and I had to figure all that out, but it is so worth it because I'm so strong in my beliefs now. I know exactly what I believe, but figuring it out at an older age is a lot different than when you're young. And so I think that anybody that wants to get out of a situation like that, it's so worth it just for your peace of mind and your just not being controlled by somebody else and being able to think on your own and not have someone else dictate how you think. Because I feel like that was my entire growing up. I never got to decide anything for myself or, you know, think for myself. It was always told what I had to do and when I had to do it. And I think knowing who you are is so amazing.
Right. And giving your children and then grandchildren the gift of that as well. It's very powerful. Thank you for that. And Rachel, how about you?
I also want to just say that my process and healing is still ongoing. I still have days where I'm questioning, have I healed fully? And it's still a process. So what I think I've taken away from that is ask a lot of questions. Trust the process. If you can't ask a lot of questions, get the fuck out. Because if you ask a lot of questions, then you can trust the process. And sometimes that's patience. But if you can't ask questions, then you're in the wrong process.
I love that. Right. And being able to question also being symbolic of freedom. And also seeing if someone is there to answer your questions and also helps you along the way, I think, learn to answer them on your own. You know, that it can, you can work together. That something I know that I try to do for my clients or for my kids. Also, I'm happy to answer this question. And then let's see if we can get to the point where you feel like you can check in internally. And if that's not working, then yes, then ask me and we can work together on this. But I love that, being able to ask questions. Very powerful. Thank you. Thank you to both of you. And I can't wait to be able to see what you put together and, you know, and be able to have it be a resource for so many people, a very practical resource. And so let people know about where they can find you if, you know, you're out there on social media and what you're working on, and then we'll have to run.
We do post a clip from our podcast each time. And so we do have a Facebook and an Instagram, which is Sisters Declassified. It's just Sisters_Declassified for Instagram and Sisters Declassified for Facebook. And then you can always reach out to us through email. It is sistersdeclassified@gmail.com. So those are the ways to do us. You can find us on Spotify. Yeah, anywhere you get your podcasts, we do a bi-weekly podcast, which is Sisters Declassified Life Survival Guide. Long word, long name, but
I love it. It's so good. So good. Such a pleasure. Anytime you want to come back on, anytime something's happening and you want to announce it, please, please, please use this as your forum. Yeah, would love it.
Thank you for having us.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Rachel.
You're welcome.
One more thing before you go. It is always so nice to speak with Rachel and with Liz. I love that they have each other and that they want to be able to come forward and tell their stories. It is very powerful to hear how they went without for so long and how much their family struggled, how much they did not have their basic needs taken care of when they were leaving. And this is after so much devotion, so much sacrifice to this particular church. You would think at the very least they would be cared for, taken care of. They would be able to have enough food to eat and money to live off of. It is the story of a lot of people who give and give and give, but just don't get back. And you're not supposed to somehow want to get back or need it. And it's wrong of you to even want it or need it. One of the things that was talked about was this idea of somehow women being temptresses. This whole notion is not something made up by this church, certainly. There are so many of these archetypes for women where they are these sirens. They wreak havoc on these men who don't have self-control and are going to be drawn in by women who are going to take them astray. And therefore, the women need to be controlled, but not the men. The men don't have to learn self-control. And what happens too is that then a woman walking by wearing something that a man might find sexy is then seen as the woman trying to get the man to think something, to have something sexual on his mind. There was a quote I came across on social media that I love, and I don't know who actually wrote it. If anyone knows, please let me know. And it's something I remember talking to Rachel and Liz about. The quote is, "Women's bodies are not responsible for men's thoughts." Simple, to the point, absolutely 100% true. But here in these situations, these religious situations, women are somehow responsible for everything that a man is thinking, for everything that might take a man into a place of not having self-control. This happens in fundamentalist branches of many religions. And that's why so many women have to wear long clothes, or they have to wear things over their clothes, over their faces, over their heads, to hide themselves so they don't tempt men. It is completely wrong, completely unfair. Doesn't say a lot about how religious groups feel about women, but it also doesn't say a lot about men. Why is it that a man wouldn't have any modicum of self-control? What's also interesting that was mentioned is that within a lot of these groups, again, something I hear a lot about, especially on the podcast, there was so much focus on sex, more than there is in the world outside. As Rachel said, we were hypersexualized while being fully clothed. That is a fascinating line. A lot of people said to me, I was thinking about sex all the time because that's all my pastor talked about. I was thinking about sex all the time because that's all my dad was warning me about. That's all my mom was warning us about. I don't remember actually ever talking about sex with my parents. Really, ever. Would have been completely uncomfortable, but it just wasn't on our minds. It wasn't brought up at the dinner table. No one watched me get dressed and talked about sex. No one warned me about it before I went on a date. There was this general sense of trust that you have the ability to say no. You have self-control. You have your own personal guidelines for what is okay and what's not okay and what you're going to let someone get away with or not. It just didn't need to be discussed all the time. The problem is that when you bring something up over and over and over again, of course, then it's going to be on people's minds. And then you say it's a sin to have it on your mind. Talk about a trap. That's like bringing up food all day long and then telling your child that if they have food on their mind, they're being gluttonous. They are involved in one of the deadly sins. Well, they wouldn't have had food on their mind if you hadn't kept bringing it up. And so I don't know if this is because people who are within religious organizations or high up on the staff feel that it is their obligation to keep warning people about these things, or if in fact it's really on their minds all that often. And so they've found this avenue to be able to just keep talking about it, but to not have to take responsibility for what it might cause, where it's going to put it on people's minds, where it's going to make people hypersexualize, thinking about their bodies, thinking about the shape of their bodies, thinking about having sex. It can really push people to the edge. And what's even more cruel is that then if you tell people if something is on your mind, that means you are a sinner or that something is wrong with you and you can't be trusted, then you really are getting people caught between a rock and a hard place. They're really sandwiched between what they're wrestling with in their own mind, in their own heart, and what you're doing to them. It would be wonderful to give people a chance just to be and explore themselves and their sexuality. But more so, it would be wonderful for other things to be the subject matter and for the message to be one of trust. Here are the guidelines. Here's what we think is best for you. And we trust you to make a good decision, to make a smart decision. And we're also going to educate the boys and the men so that they know they need to respect you. They know they need to listen to you saying no. And they know that if they're having sexual feelings towards you, you didn't make that happen in them. They just naturally had it. And then they can't just go into blaming you. They actually need to take a moment and learn self-control so that they can switch it off, so that they can think about other things, so that they can say, even though I'm having that feeling, I'm not going to blame the woman or the girl for it. Even if I'm having these feelings, it doesn't mean that the other person, the female in most situations, but not all, is making me feel this way. And so then somehow she deserves for me to take advantage of her. And she deserves for me to cross her boundaries. Because after all, she's crossing mine by making me feel something that I don't want to feel. It is such a jumbled picture that is made so needlessly complicated and so needlessly blaming. I am so glad that the people I speak with, especially people like Rachel and Liz, have a chance to have an impact in their own lives so that they can see they are trustworthy people, but also in the lives of their own children or nieces and nephews and the other children they come across, the other people they come across in their life. And anyone listening to this who really has been given this sense that you have caused something to happen to you, you've caused someone to lose control and then feel they have access to your body. It's just not the case that you need to take responsibility for that. Another person has the ability to choose right from wrong. Another person has a sense of control over what they decide to do to another person. And so if you have been given this sense that somehow you're to blame and you need to feel guilty for just being, for just looking a certain way or dressing a certain way, I want you to be able to take that control back and realize that there's nothing that you did just by being, just by standing somewhere, just by wearing something. But there is something another person did if they took advantage of that. If they blame you for what they're feeling and their own urges. But I also hope one day just natural urges are not demonized. This would make the picture even easier. If people could just have their feelings and their drives, and they could be normalized so that people didn't have to be so afraid of each other and afraid of themselves. I'll talk to you next week.
Thank you very much for listening. Please support Indoctrination on Patreon at patreon.com/indoctrination. Be sure to give us a follow on our social media. Find us on Facebook and Instagram using @indoctrinationpodcast. And for Twitter, find us @_indoctrination. We love hearing from you too. So send us an email at indoctrinationshow@gmail.com. And for more updates on the show, visit our website at www.podpage.com/indoctrination.